Thank you, Brother Richard, and brethren, it's a pleasure again to be with you. We were asked to give a subject from something, you know, from our Heritage of Truth and the volumes and so forth, and the Chart of the Ages is the foundation of it all. Now, the Chart of the Ages is something that you know. So what can you say for, you know, half hour and 45 minutes about something that you already know about? Well, there are some technical details about the chart, but we're going to first just kind of review the basic point of the chart. Now, one of the things that I think was fundamental when Brother Russell began to understand the divine plan of the ages was to put it in a form that would be readily and easily understood. And what this chart of the ages is not something that was invented by Brother Russell and only appears in the first volume. There were charts of various sorts. Now, in our San Diego ecclesia, there was a gentleman named Brother Robert Kinney, some of you might know, and he was excellent book table chairman, and he had books of, you know, from other writers and other fellowships that also had charts. They weren't as good as this, I assure you, but they were charts. And it was, in the Miller movement, quite common to have large panoramic displays and charts and so forth. So in that tradition, he proceeded. Did you change that for me, or was that...
No, you can
have
changed.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, there we go. Oh, I see. Okay. So, but when Brother Russell started to become involved and wanted to provide a diagram that would be helpful to brethren, the basic... Is this working at all? It's okay. The basic concept of the chart is that there are not one, but two ages of redemption. Now, I think I mentioned the other day that when I have an opportunity, maybe it was another location I was saying this, but when I have an opportunity to speak the truth to somebody, you know, for a few minutes, just a few minutes, like at a fair booth opportunity that we have in San Diego, we, you know, had for many years, the one thing I tell them is that we believe in two ages of redemption. Now, all Christians believe at least in one age of redemption. They just don't see the distinction between the two. But we, of course, have the gospel age followed by here called the messianic age. We'll talk about that title in just a minute. And that opens up the whole divine plan, because the whole purpose of Christianity and the development to be with Christ is for a job. And that job is Revelation 20, verse 6. They will be priests of God and shall reign with Christ 1,000 years for the uplift, of course, of the rest of the world and mankind. So that's the fundamental point. Now, people also don't carefully distinguish the Jewish age from every other age. But in the Jewish age, God called his people Israel, and they were not called to a heavenly hope. You know, a lot of Christians have this mixed up, and they don't quite understand the distinction between the faith that all of these people before Christ had and what reward that would give them, and the distinction between that and the gospel age call of the saints. But of course, that gospel age call is unique. It was never known before. It was never revealed. Even the disciples didn't really understand that it was going to be a heavenly hope ruling from heaven until time progressed. And then Jesus, you know, in his last time with them, he said at the Last Supper, you know, on that occasion, he says, he told them about, if I go away, I will come again and receive you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. Now, they got the idea after his resurrection that this was a different person. This was a spiritual being. He would disappear and come and go as the wind, you know. But even then, things weren't really, really clear. So Peter said, just before Jesus was ready to leave, I see now, Lord, will you at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? And the answer basically was, not yet. He didn't say, no, that's a foolish concept. He says, it's not given for you to know the times and the seasons in God's plan. Well, now, it is given to us to know those times and seasons. We're at the end. You remember the book of Daniel? Daniel had a lot of prophetic visions, and he couldn't understand them, and he would really like to, wouldn't you, if an angel visited you? And Brother Graham sitting there, and all of a sudden an angel comes in and says, Brother Graham, I've got something to tell you. We'd really like to know the meaning. But Daniel, he just couldn't. And the angel said, just close up the book, Daniel. It's not for you. But in the time of the end, the wise will understand. And we're in that time today. So we know a lot more about things than even Peter, the apostle, knew when Jesus was ready to leave him. But Peter knew very well, because he says later, the precious promises that we have give us a divine hope and a spiritual reward. And that's a wonderful thing. All Christendom basically knows there's a spiritual reward, but they lost the fact that there's going to be something for the world and mankind after that. That is really the heart and soul of the truth. And when Brother Russell was studying early, there was a little problem, you know, with the ransom, with Brother Barber. And then they got into the tabernacle studies, and there was some dissension on that. But when Brother Russell saw that in Leviticus 16, on the Day of Atonement, there was first an application for Aaron and the priests of the blood of atonement. And after that, then another application of the blood for the people generally. Well, what does that tell us? But that there are two times when the blood of Christ is going to be used to reconcile people. The first would be the gospel age, and the second would be the millennial age. So that really, I think, really sealed to him, okay, this is all coming together. And so the chart of the ages was published about that time, or you know, the Divine Plan of the Ages, the first volume, wasn't published for a few more years after that. It really wasn't as early as we think. The very first book published by him independently was Tabernacle Shadows. That was like 1881, something like that. And the other books followed after. So, and this chart of the ages, you know, it's pretty straightforward. The world that was up to the time of the flood, and then the present evil world, which is what Paul refers to, up to the time of the kingdom, and then the world to come wherein dwells righteousness. That's pretty straightforward. But in this present evil world after the flood, before the Jewish age really began with the law covenant, we had people of faith from Noah all the way through to Jacob, and then with his 12 sons when they left Egypt and they came at the time of the Exodus, and then they came to Mount Sinai. That really began the Jewish law and the Jewish age that in a sense began there. You could begin it perhaps as early as the death of Jacob, because that's when God began to work with the sons of the 12 sons. That's fine. That's actually more customary. So there's the Jewish age, and then we get to this period of the harvest. Now, we get some complexity in here. We're going to talk about that complexity and why it is and how we should evaluate that in light of our current day. But we have here a harvest, and then we have another harvest here. Now, the fact that there is a period of time called a harvest in the divine plan is very straightforward. In Matthew, the 13th chapter, Jesus says, the harvest is the end of the age. And when he said the word end, he used, well, what can I say? He wasn't speaking Greek. But in the record that we have, in the Greek translation, it is the word soontelia. And that doesn't mean the final climax. It means an ending period. Vine's expository dictionary says an order and events toward the conclusion. So a harvest is really a period of time during which things come to closure. And that period of time lasted, oh, sometimes we say 40 years in the Jewish age. You could extend it farther than that, maybe to 135 and the end of the Jerusalem control by the Jews. And now the harvest of the gospel age appears to be even longer. I say appears to be because we lived well beyond the 40 years that was expected. We keep on going. There's an article 5950, the harvest is not ended. And that, I think, is still applicable today. This closing period of transition between the gospel age and the kingdom is still operating. It's still going on. Now, I know that sometimes because of the length of time, you begin to wonder, okay, well, really, is it? What's going on? I mean, it's so much longer than we expected. But without a propensity to get into years and dates directly, just look at the broad picture of what God gives us in symbol and in type about the closing of the present gospel age. And I'm thinking in particular about the time of Elijah. Now, something you all know. You know that Elijah, during his period of his prophethood, there was 3.5 years of drought. Now, it's interesting. We don't really know precisely how long that was, except for the New Testament tells us. But James says it was 3 years and 6 months. And that's a period during the gospel age of the 1260 years where there was kind of a drought for spiritual things, and then things got better. You know, after the French Revolution and after the Bible societies came in, Bibles began to be published, and things looked brighter. So from that time forward, the experiences of Elijah change, and there's this confrontation with the priest of Baal. I think that confrontation represents kind of a deciding confrontation between two views of Christianity. The Protestant view that says Jesus was our Redeemer and you have to believe by faith, and the Catholic view that says you're saved by being a member of our church and the person in charge is the Pope. And those two views of the atonement came into conflict. In 1799, 1789, that period of history when papacy was put down and the Napoleonic Wars swept over Europe and put papacy's power, you know, down, it was quite clear that that wasn't the answer. Okay, now it's a long-winded introduction, but I want to get to the point of what happened to Elijah after that. He had to flee to Mount Horeb. And as he fled to Mount Horeb, it tells you it was 40 days that he was going to Mount Horeb. And that 40 days, sometimes by the brethren, is considered to be the period from the beginning of the harvest here, the end of the age, something that we would say when Christ returned in 1874, 40 years later, when the time of trouble would begin. Now, maybe at one time, you know, all the brethren thought the church would be complete by then, but this tells us basically no, that after the 40 years beginning with the Lord's return, it would take you to the time of trouble, and the time of trouble is going to last an undetermined amount of time. But do you remember what Elijah saw when he was at Mount Horeb as a picture of the time of trouble? You remember he saw, God said, come to the mouth of the cave. I've got something I want to show you. And he showed him the wind that swept over and broke the rocks of the mountains. And then he showed him a great earthquake that shook everything. And then he showed him the fire that swept over the hillside and, you know, burned up all the remnant. And those are three phases of the time of trouble. But how long would they take? Now, maybe at one time the brethren thought it would be fairly rapid succession. Even when Brother Russell wrote his last comments on when he expected the church to go home, that you'll see that in Volume 3, in the foreword to Volume 3, he wrote that in, 1916? And when did he die? 1916, just a date after, about a month after that publication. And he says, we still expect that within a year or two, well, let's be cautious here, maybe three, all the saints would be complete. You know, it just didn't happen. And here we are all these years later. Well, the resolution here is to recognize that these three waves of the time of trouble are not 1 or 2 or 3 months or years, but they're decades-long affairs. Now we're in a position to look at the wind phase of that time of trouble and know how long it really lasted. Now, winds in Daniel represent wars. That's a common, you know, concept in Daniel. The winds swept over the restless sea and four world empires came out of it. The winds of war started, in our time, in 1914. That was World War I. And what we didn't know, I say we collectively, I wasn't even there, you know, most of us weren't, but what we collectively didn't think about was maybe there's another phase to the wind. But there was. In 1939, there was World War II. Now, I don't expect a World War III. I don't think we're going to have a nuclear holocaust that's going to wipe the plate clean and start all over. I don't think that. Remember the scripture? The wrath of God shall praise him. The remainder of wrath he will restrain. That would not be praiseworthy to level society and all the progress we've made and start from scratch again. We're done with the wind phase. That ended in 1945. That means this wind phase lasted for like a little more than three decades. And now you get into the earthquake phase. After World War II, what happened? Well, you had, after World War II, all of a sudden, all these nations that were under the thumb of colonial empires began to get free. Now, the war ended in 1945. And I think one of the first countries to get free, in fact, I think the first one, was Pakistan. 1947, and about a month or some weeks later, India. That was a big one. That was a major part of the British Empire. 1948, the one that really is dear to us, Israel in 1948. But after that, Africa, all the African nations in the 1960s. In the 1970s, Indochina, and all of the satellites of the French Empire. But there was one more big empire that had to fall apart, and that was the Soviet Empire. And that was 1989, when, you know, half a dozen countries got free and everything changed. I remember that. Now you're getting to the time when I was alive thinking and looking at prophecy, and I was surprised. Now that kind of surprise, you know, hit most of the brethren. I know one brother in America that's about my age, a little younger, and he said, I expected that. I said, well, hats off, you know, I didn't. But that tells us something about prophecy. Keep your eyes open. Let us speak of myself, keeping my eyes open. Because we may have the best idea of what might be going on, but when things, events unfold, that'll tell us what really is going on, and we better readjust our sights to the facts. That's the issue. Now, I can take a little tangent here and just say, I think we generally appreciate that the high calling is still operating, and it's still going on, and I think there's very good evidence for that. But you know, if you didn't refocus your sight on this, you might say, well, we expected the church to be complete. Maybe the calling is all over. So it's always important to look at what's happening and look at the facts and then gauge your understanding and modify if necessary accordingly. Okay, so we've got, we're in the harvest. So that tells us if the wind phase lasted a little over three decades, and if the earthquake phase from 45 to 89 lasted a little over four decades, then maybe the fire phase is not just, you know, a blink of an eye, but it's also a decade-long affair. Now, I think so. I think it's on the order of about five decades. We'll see. So what is that fire phase? Well, what happened after 1989 was something, again, that I didn't expect. I still remember I was in an airport coming home from a convention somewhere, and I watched the CNN monitor to see what the news was for the day. And I heard Iraq just invaded Kuwait. And I was stunned. I said, what's going on? What does this mean? Does this have some meaning for what's going to happen next? And until you're some years beyond it, you can't really know. You've got to get a historical perspective. But now looking backward, that was what precipitated the first Gulf War. After that came 9/11. And then the second Gulf War. And then the Afghan War. And then it just keeps on going. The Arab Spring. And then the Syrian Civil War. And today, the Middle East is more of a quagmire than it has ever been before. Now, I remember when the United States went, you know, this is when Bush was president. He said he's going to intervene and help Kuwait. Seems like a noble thing to do. I'm glad I'm not a politician that makes those decisions. We wouldn't really know. But in retrospect, right now, the Middle East is in worse shape than ever before. And, you know, God knows what's happening, but everything is shaping up. It's shaping up just the way Ezekiel said. Iran is becoming more powerful. That's one of the enemies of Israel. Damascus in Isaiah 17, it says it'll be a ruinous heap. They're kind of going in that direction today. It says in Isaiah 19 that Egypt would be torn with internal strife, and maybe that explains why they're not one of the attackers of Israel in the last battle. Everything's shaping up. We're moving in that direction. How long do we have to go? Well, you know, I think we have about a generation to go. Let's put it in loose terms. I think that's viable, reasonable, and rational. About 10 years from now, we'll see if there's a turn of events that will kind of confirm our opinion or not. But I'd say on the order of four or five decades for that third piece is about in the right order. So here we are in the harvest, and it's a long period. Now, spend a lot of time on the harvest for two reasons. First of all, because that's where we are today. And secondly, because that is a crucial point that divides your understanding and mine from that of many others in Christendom who do not really understand that we're in a period of transition from one age to the other. That's what the harvest is, completing one age and introducing another. Because they don't see that there will be a thousand-year kingdom. They just don't get it. So the understanding that there's a lengthy transitional period is really very synchronous with our whole understanding of what's going to happen in the future. Now, I said we might talk about this title, Messianic Age. If you look on just about any chart of the ages, you'll see it says Messianic Age. But you know, it didn't always say that. As a matter of fact, for most of the years of the truth movement in the days of Brother Russell, it did not say that. It said something else. millennial age. And we still use that prolifically. I do all the time. Talk about the millennial age. When did that change? Do you know when that changed to messianic? I didn't know myself, but you know, some of you know Brother George Tabak in Chicago. He's researched a lot of this, and he showed me the documentation that the change was made late in 1913. Now, why did he change that? Why? He didn't change much on the chart. Why did he change that? Well, I think it's because of his awareness that, in fact, the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 would not begin here, but it would begin here. And therefore, when he realized that little adjustment, he thought, well then, this age that he shows incipiently beginning here, maybe we should change that title and make it the broader messianic age to include the time from the time Messiah returned at his Lord's return forward. But millennial age, you know, that would really be constricted to the millennium itself. Now, if you want to read more on that, then I would suggest that one article, I think I mentioned it yesterday, article 2739 in the reprints, where Brother Russell has asked this question about the 1,000 years. And the questioner is basically saying, tell us just exactly, when does the 1,000 years begin? And Brother Russell has a very engaging answer to that. It's an answer that we, you know, all should use frequently in a similar situation. Now, I don't know, and there's something about this subject that the Lord has not been pleased to reveal to us. But then he adds, at the end of the article, but this we know. He quotes Revelation 20, verse 4, and he says, this cannot begin until all of the jewels are complete. He means until the church is finished in glory. Now, I believe he's right. You know, for a long time, I knew that article was there, but I just didn't think he had the right answer. Now I think he had the right answer, and that is that the millennium begins after the church is complete. Now, the reign of Christ, of course, starts here when he returns as king, but the 1,000 years is a period of priestly blessing for the world. That's the difference. That's the difference. Okay, now there's been a lot of discussion on that by the brethren, as you know. So, looking here at some of the more detailed parts. Oh, you know, I should get into these various curves before we get into some of these levels. We have the harvest here of the Jewish age, and we have it kind of as a beginning for the gospel age. And you see how many beginnings there are on the chart for the beginning. How many are there? Three. That's it. Yeah. One, two, three. Now, why three? Well, that's coming from the prophecy of the 70 weeks. The 70-week prophecy, as understood by Brother Russell in Volume 2, was that the 69 weeks would take you to the presence of Jesus. So that's Jesus, and that's where he begins his ministry as a perfect man. And then 3.5 years later, he would die. So he died there. He was raised. And then raised to glory, that's Jesus' spirit begotten. Then he died. Then he was raised to glory, but with the disciples for 40 days, then raised to be with the Heavenly Father. And then this last one here, he thought would be 3.5 years later with Cornelius, and that would be the opening of the gospel to the Gentiles. Now, that's the reason he has three. And here, you find three beginnings to this next messianic age that parallel those as well. 1874, 1878, 1881. But now we're a long ways beyond that, and you look back and you say, is that really precise? Is that really correct? And I see some heads waving one way or another. You know, I've studied this and I have an opinion. My opinion is that the 70 weeks are a little different than he thought. Now, I say that based upon the fact that there is historical evidence today that really tells us the right dates for the history of the Persian kings. And today, I think that we can recognize that, in fact, the 70 weeks ended with the year that Jesus died on the cross. Now, this is not a discussion on that, so I'm just going to mention that. That's all. Just mention that. So I might readjust some of these curves here. And, you know, I have been known at one time to draw a chart for some of the people we're witnessing to publicly and put maybe 7 curves, you know, in there just to show that the whole thing, this age faded out and this age, you know, gradually came in. And over here, should we start, you know, put another line here? Well, with the Lord's return, that's fine. Maybe the return of Israel in 1878, okay, that's fine. I don't think the parallel date of 1881 applies because I don't think it jives here. 1914, that'd be another step. Would 1948 be another step? You know, would each part of the 3 periods of... Yeah, you could draw a number of things that would show gradual beginnings of the next age. So here we've got 3, and I have no real objection because that 3 kind of represents the fact that each of these age started in steps and in stages. We might have different opinions upon what precise steps or stages to mark, but it tells you that things open gradually in a series of events that gradually unfold. So that's all I think we'll say about that for now. So let's go to these levels on the chart. Now, these levels are pretty straightforward. Here's the level where Adam was created first, and that's the level of human perfection. But then, of course, Adam fell, and so he fell to the plane of sin and death. And that's where we've all been, the race of mankind, until finally the mankind is lifted up in the kingdom. So the difference between this and this is merely the difference between the world under the world that was, and the world under the present evil world. Otherwise, these are the 2 same classes, the same location. It's just the world in 2 different periods of the divine plan. Here we have Israel, a little bit higher than the world of mankind, because they were God's covenant people. But they weren't perfect, so you can't put them up here. So what are you going to do? Just kind of put them in the middle there somewhere, you know. Just a picture to show they're still condemned, unworthy. But they have a little higher standing than the world of mankind, but not yet perfect. So we pass on to this period of when Jesus came. And now we see Jesus here kind of on the level of human perfection with Adam, because he was a perfect human. But that causes us to wonder about this one. Who in the world is that that could compete with Adam and Jesus to be perfect? You all know the answer, I think. But the answer in this case is that it was somebody of faith whose faith was strong enough so that it was counted unto him for righteousness. Now, who would that man be in the patriarchal age? Abraham. And so God said, Brother Russell said, we'll put him here to kind of represent all of the people of faith from Adam up through John the Baptist and a little further. So that's just representative. You could have put that right here and said that's Abel and everybody of faith that follows him. But Father Abraham, we consider the father of the faithful. So we'll put it here in the patriarchal age. Okay, so now we get to Jesus, and 3.5 years later, he dies. He dies as a perfect man for our redemption. Why is there a cross down here? Well, that's because not only did he die for the sin of Adam, but the method by which he died also allowed him to take the burden of the Jewish law away from the Jewish people. It wasn't 2 deaths. It was 1 death that incorporated 2 features. One, that he died. That's fundamental. And second, that he died on the tree, on the cross. Now, you know the scripture in Galatians. Is it Galatians 3:13? Somewhere around there. And Paul says, Jesus was made a curse for us, as it is written under the law in Deuteronomy, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. So he had to hang on a tree, not for us Gentiles, but for the Jewish nation, who was subject to the penalty of the Jewish law. So that's why on the chart we kind of have 2 crosses. He didn't die twice. He died only once, but once he died for everyone. And secondly, the method of his crucifixion, of his death, was to relieve Israel of the burden of the law. Now, there's more to this, these 2 views about the death of Jesus. Now, you remember that every day in the Jewish law, there was a sacrifice of a lamb in the morning and in the afternoon. Now, when exactly did these things take place? Well, that's subject to some dispute, but morning and afternoon, that we know. Morning and afternoon. A lamb in the morning, a lamb later on. Every day, two lambs for a burnt offering. Why two lambs? I mean, Jesus died once for us, so if you want to kind of predict and memorialize in advance the death of Jesus, maybe a lamb every day, something like that. But there's two lambs. And I think maybe those two lambs remind us of the death of Jesus when he was put on the cross in the morning, and then he expired in the afternoon. But those two times are meaningful because I think they pertain to two classes. He had to die finally for everyone. But put on the cross in the morning is to die specifically for the Jewish nation to relieve them from the curse of the law. Now, these two times when Jesus was put on the cross and then he expired, do you know what time of day it was that he was put on the cross, Brother Ray?
9 a.m.
Okay, and when did he die?
3 p.m.
How many hours between those two? 6 hours, maybe to atone for the 6,000 years of sin and death if the curse is upon the world. Now that, actually, that seems a connection that seems kind of evident to me. But, you know, I didn't think of that. I was giving a presentation at a convention, a little study. Somebody mentioned that. It was Richard Kindig. He mentioned that. I thought, oh my goodness, how could I miss that? 6 hours for the 6,000 years. I think it makes sense. But those 6 hours, well, that was an agonizing period. But those times are actually found later in the record of the book of Acts about what happened as a consequence of Jesus' death. Now you say 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. Okay, I think that's right. It's called the third hour of the day from daybreak and the ninth hour of the day from daybreak. When you go to the book of Acts and you find the first time that the blood of Christ is going to be used to redeem someone, that was on the day that we know as Pentecost, 50th day. Jesus had gone into glory for 10 days earlier, and now he's told them to assemble, you know, together. They're all together on the day of Pentecost, and suddenly a rushing mighty wind fills the house, and all the people there are impressed by some divine intervention. And then over the heads of the 12 apostles, well, I'll just leave that for now. That's another subject. All of a sudden appears a flame of fire, a tongue of fire, as though to say these are the spokesmen for this new age. And this was an awesome experience. What time of day did that happen? We're actually told, because later, when they're speaking in tongues, the apostles, they're out in the street speaking in tongues, talking about Jesus, and all of the people that came to Pentecost from various nations who were Jewish roots, but they would speak different languages, they heard the apostles speaking in their own language. And somebody said, these men are drunk, because they just heard this babble, they didn't understand it. Let's say again. Say that again.
Too early.
Peter says, these men are not drunk, it's too early. What time of the day was it? They could guess. The third hour of the day. You know, I don't drink. But I guess when you drink, you want to have more later in the day when the day hasn't worked out for you. I don't know. But early in the morning, too early for people to drink and get drunk. So he says, the third hour of the day. What that means is the Pentecostal blessing came on the Jewish believers who were assembled at the same hour of the day that Jesus was put on the cross to relieve the Jewish nation. It's, I don't think, a coincidence. It's exactly the same hour. Now, it could have been that we wouldn't have known that hour. But without that accusation and Peter's response, how could we know? But it's supplied for us. Now, that's the second chapter of Acts. Now in the next chapter, in the third chapter of Acts, we get another episode that's remarkable. Now you probably all know in your mind, Acts 3:19-21, whom the heavens must retain till the times of restoration of all things. That's emblazoned in every brother and sister's mind. You know, it's from the time I was a kid. But you know what introduced that was an episode starting in the first verse of the third chapter, where Peter and John are going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. That's the hour when Jesus died. Well, that was the hour of prayer in the temple, and that makes a nice connection between Jesus dying at the time that the second lamb of the day was being killed in the temple at the hour of prayer. But what did they encounter as they went up there? They encountered a lame man at the gate. And this man had been lame from his birth. And they healed him in the name of Jesus. I think that lame man represents me and you. All of us that by birth are Gentiles. We've been lame from birth. Now the Jews have had the Jewish law. They've had some connection to God. But not us. Us Gentiles, speaking very collectively, we were without hope in the world. And there's this lame from birth. And they healed him. And I think that represents the call of the Gentile believers at the ninth hour. So you see, when Jesus was put on the cross, the third hour, that's the same time when the Jewish believers received it. When he's put on the cross in the ninth hour, I think that's a picture of the time when Gentiles would receive it. Now, wouldn't it be even better if we knew the hour when Cornelius was converted? You know? Well, we do. And guess what hour it was? Ninth hour. That was the ninth hour that the angel appeared to Cornelius and said, you're going to call for a man named Peter. He's going to come. And whatever he says, you listen to it, and that's my message. That angel appeared, it says, about the ninth hour. And I think that's not coincidence. That's when the Gentiles got the blessing, the same hour that Jesus actually died on the cross. So these two crosses, that's kind of a little part of the chart that we don't, focus on a lot. I always kind of confused me a little bit, to be honest, when I was a kid. But I think that's a very nice arrangement to show that he died in a way for the Jews by crucifixion. And then, of course, for us Gentiles, all of us in Adam, he had to die to take that penalty. Now, when we mentioned this once to somebody in a convention, it was in Albuquerque, and a brother came up later and he had a note for me. And the note was, there's something more to dying on the tree. Now, I think he's right. And that is, why is it that all of us die at all? It's because of the fall of Adam. Well, how did that come about? Well, it was they sinned at the tree. That's what they did. They ate the tree that they shouldn't have eaten of. Now, it was the tree of life. Now, I think ultimately, they probably would have been able to eat of that tree in God's due time, once they showed their fidelity. And I think the whole world of mankind is going to have right to the tree of life in the kingdom in the 1,000 years. But it's premature. You're not trying to grant everlasting life until you prove your fidelity and your faithfulness. And so they inappropriately ate it, and they sinned at the tree, and so Jesus died on the tree as an atonement for that sin. So we get now here into the gospel age, and we see this pyramid. And, I think we already mentioned, this is Jesus when he was at Jordan, spirit begotten as a new creature. And then he was raised to spirit life. And finally he went into the ascension of glory. Now, I remember when I was just in Sunday school still, and somebody, it was Brother Levi Jacobs, if anybody even known him in past years, a very dynamic brother on the East Coast, and as a matter of fact, I even remember that Sunday school. Your father was with me in that Sunday school. We were both together. I just happen to remember your father was there too. And he gave this this presentation, and I asked him this question. What's the difference between plain L and plain K? I mean, did he change his state when he went from there to there? And he explained, and I think that's the explanation also in Volume 1, that this change is not really a change of personal state or nature, but rather a change in the glory and office that he attained. So that after 40 days, he rose and sat on the right hand of God. Now, all of this is just a picture to give us a visual impression of some truths that we know. Now, don't we all know that, in fact, Jesus, after 40 days, ascended on high to the glory? And that's merely a diagrammatic way to show that. Now, here's Jesus during the gospel age, and here's Jesus at his return. Does he lose some of his glory because he's returned? No. This is just a diagrammatic way to show he's coming back. And meanwhile, the saints are going up. That's all. Just a picture way of saying it. You could fault that on precision, but it's just a diagrammatic way of showing this point. So, this during the age would be all of those that are accumulated as part of the Christian church. Well, there's the saints. There's those that are spirit begotten, the great company. Those are the ones who believe, are justified by faith, they're believers. Down here are the people that just kind of hang on. They go, you know, they're part of the old nominal systems. They're really tares. They're really not truly good believers at all. But that's the way the Christian church existed. And now during the harvest, you find all these pieces separated. There's the church going to the reward, the great company going through the great tribulation, the believers that are now going to be part of the world of mankind, and the tares lose all concept of what's going on, and they'll be part of the world as well. We move on to the world. There's the world of mankind, Israel as kind of a leading light to them, the great company, the church class in glory beyond, and there's second death extending beyond 1,000 years at the end. That's it. That's the chart of the ages. Now, that's nothing you didn't know, but some details that maybe kind of triggered a few thoughts in your mind. So what do we have here on the far right? The tabernacle in the wilderness. And there, it's arranged so that this level of human justification or perfection, either way, is what you see when you get into the court. People that are in the court represent people that believe in what Jesus did for them. And they have a standing before God as a consequence. You move on to spirit begettal, and you see the table of showbread, the lampstand, and the golden altar. Now, I'll just give you a little thought on that table of showbread. If I was to ask you, what was on the table of showbread, you would answer, showbread. That was it. There's bread there. Now, another presentation, we have a picture of a table with just two stacks of bread. That's it. And then we have another picture I also got from the internet that shows considerably more on that table. Now, we studied the book of Exodus closely in our class, and somebody brought this to my attention. I didn't see it. It's the benefit of collective study. They said the King James says about this that in addition to bread, there were covers to cover with all. What does that mean? Covers to cover with all. Well, if you look in the NIV or any modern translation, you find it says a pitcher to pour out a drink offering. The first cover is any round vessel, and in this case translated pitcher. It's a jug, or as some old versions say, a flagon. And the other is to cover. It means to pour out. You can cover a table, you know, if you pour out liquid on it. And I didn't know, but apparently on this table there was bread and a jug of wine. Now, when we found that out, I did a little research for Jewish sources to see what they thought about it. And they all agree. There was a jug of wine on the table. So I began to talk to brethren about this privately. Everybody thought that seems to be what it is. So then we timidly, you know, ventured to give it publicly. And I think the brethren picked up on it nicely. So if that's true, and I think it is, when you walk into this tabernacle and you look to your right, what you see is bread and wine. Now, if we always knew that what you saw was bread and wine, what would that mean to us? Ezra, what was bread and wine? Who do you think of when you think of bread and wine? Jesus, my body and my blood. So what you see here when you enter is there's Jesus on the right. That's what he's done for us. You look to the left, the 7-branch menorah. That's the church. That's us who are trying to hold forth the light of truth as best we can. And here, there's the golden altar at which both Jesus and the church render their praise, thanksgiving, honor, and grace to God. And then finally, you go beyond the most holy into heaven itself, into glory. Well, thank you, brethren. I think that's our time has really expired and beyond. You've been very gracious, but our time is up. And we'll turn the meeting back over to Brother Richard.